Hello, I'm Elizabeth Coffey, the Managing Director of the Lake Institute on Faith and Giving, part of the Indiana University Lilly Family School of Philanthropy. We focus on the relationship between religion and generosity through research, education, and public conversations. The Distinguished Visitor Series is one of those conversations. It's our way of inviting a leading scholar or practitioner to share insight on faith and giving. We're especially excited today to be in conversation with both Dr. Jack Wertheimer and Rabbi Adam Miller. We're excited because what you both know about the relationship between religion and generosity has so much to teach the diverse participants in our programs, and we're grateful for that. So that's why we're recording this interview, to serve as a resource for future learners across faith traditions who are thinking deeply about generosity, institutions, and meaning. So for our listeners, Dr. Jack Wertheimer is Emeritus Professor of American Jewish History at the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York. His scholarship centers on modern Jewish life, particularly in the religious and communal trends shaping American Jewry since World War II. His book is out and you can purchase it. It is called Jewish Giving, Philanthropy and the Shaping of the American Jewish Life. So I encourage you to go check that out. And he is also our 2025 Lake Institute on Faith and Giving Distinguished Visitor. So we're grateful for you being here. We also have Rabbi Adam Miller with us today. He is the senior rabbi at Temple Shalom in Naples, Florida. Rabbi Miller is also the vice chair of the advisory board for the Lake Institute on Faith and Giving, and we thank you for your service on that and your wisdom that you give to us. So thank you both for being here. I'm going to jump in with our first question, and it's to you, Jack. How would you describe what makes American Jewish giving unique, both in its motivations and in its methods?
So thank you, Elizabeth. I'm delighted to be here with you and also with Rabbi Miller. Mm-hmm. So there are a number of different facets to American Jewish giving that are not necessarily the same as for other groups. One of the great questions that Jews have had to ask themselves is, to what extent are they giving to parochial Jewish causes? To what extent do they want to give to non-sectarian causes? And often the answer is to both, and then the question is, how do they prioritize those two? To which do they give more of their dollars? To which do they give fewer of their dollars? And that, of course, changes over the course of time. So that's one of the questions. But the other question is even the more basic one, and that is, what is Jewish giving? Is Jewish giving a matter of giving in support of causes that primarily aid fellow Jews? Or is Jewish giving motivated by what people like to think about as their Jewish values? And in that case, their Jewish values may prompt them to give to support a hospital or to support research into a particular illness, which benefits Jews as well as many other people as well. So those are two of the basic questions that Jews have to ask themselves. But in many other ways, Jewish giving is not so different from that of other types of populations, in the sense that they are giving to non-sectarian causes in the desire and through the motivation of wanting to help people who are in need.
I'd love to know how you see that translate also in your own setting, in your own community, both how the practice in the synagogue of supporting the work of the congregation, but then also this calling to support communal causes as well. How do you see that play out with your community?
Well, thank you, Elizabeth and Dr. Wertheimer. It's always a pleasure to learn from you in different ways, be able to have this kind of a discussion and dialogue with you in this setting. I think it's also important to realize we're in a different time now than we've been in Jewish history before this point, that we, if you look back to the early part of the 20th century, and you know this, and it's in your book, and I encourage people to read this book and learn this history, there was a time when Jewish giving was primarily because there were resources that were needed because the Jewish community didn't have access to them otherwise. There's a reason why there were Jewish hospitals and Jewish schools and Jewish centers, because they didn't have access to mainstream pieces of society around them. With those barriers that broke down in the 20th century, you then started to see what I experience today in my own community, which is this question of, do you give within the Jewish community? Are you giving to causes that your Jewish values inspire you to give to, but are part of the larger community around you? Understanding that being such a small percentage of the population, if the Jewish community is not giving to itself, who's going to support it? If we're not giving to the synagogues, to the Jewish day schools, to the Jewish-focused organizations, it's unlikely that those who are outside of the Jewish community will give to them. And at the same time, it's important to give to the hospitals and the schools and the medical centers and all those other pieces that are very much a part of our values. And so you see this playing out in communities where it's a question of how do you give in a way that's both supportive of your own community and also fits your values in a more universal sense.
I want to just jump in and add one additional element to this story to round it out. And that what is distinctive about Jewish giving is that there is probably a stronger impulse to help Jews in other countries than is true in many other faith communities. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't people, Italian Americans, who are concerned about whatever it is that's going on in Italy. When there was an earthquake in Italy, for example, there was a rush to speed funding there within the Italian American community. But the consistent support to aid Jews in other lands, especially in Israel since 1948, but even before that, in the upbuilding of the land, that has been an important thread in American Jewish giving.
Okay, so that's so helpful to get some historical context, and I think that our listeners would love even more. So a short history lesson then from you would be amazing. What is a story from Jewish history, American history, or that would help the larger community understand the patterns of Jewish giving and why they are the way they are, but also how that continues to influence Jewish giving today?
Right. Well, your use of the word patterns is important here because this is not a static phenomenon in the sense that as new needs arise, or old needs for that matter, return, there are shifts that occur in what gets emphasized and what does not. So that in earlier eras of American Jewish history, which goes all the way back to 1654, during the colonial era, and all the way through the 19th century, as masses of immigrants arrived, there the focus was very much on aiding needy Jews, indigent Jews, who needed to be to settle in this country and aided in their absorption process in the United States. As the tide of Jewish immigration began to recede, the emphasis became much more on foreign needs, especially as those foreign needs increased. And by foreign needs, I mean the needs of Jews in different lands. And more recently, the focus has been increasingly also on strengthening the, if you will, the internal lives of Jews, in the sense of strengthening Jewish religious institutions, strengthening educational and cultural institutions, in order to address a population of Jews that needs a stronger Jewish education to understand why be Jewish.
It's so helpful to understand the context, and it helps me understand. I'm wondering also for our listeners, how does that inform motivations for giving and motivations across the Jewish community or in your interviews with Jewish philanthropists? What themes or motivations did you see coming to the surface?
Right. So the question of motivations is always a fascinating one because one doesn't really know whether the answer one receives to that question are really what the motivations are. So all I can talk about is what people will say, which doesn't necessarily mean that that's what makes them tick. But for some, the motivation is a religious motivation. And that's true not only of Jews, that's true of Christians, it's true of Muslims in this country, it's true of other faith communities as well. When there are religious imperatives, such as the biblical imperative to tithe, to give a tenth of one's earnings, That is a motivation for some Jewish people as well as for other Americans. Another motivation is to be good-hearted and to be concerned with the needs of one's fellow human beings. And so especially during COVID, what I heard often was a sense of frustration that people of means had, that they wanted to do something to help because they were aware of the food scarcity and the housing issues and also the psychological counseling needs that people had. And lots of wealthy people did not know what to do other than to contribute money. So that they did that. They gave to food pantries, for example. And those food pantries, in some cases, aided specifically Jews, such as Holocaust survivors. But in other cases, they were open to all comers. So that's a second motivation, certainly. And then there are specifically Jewish motivations of being aware, and this comes back to a point that Rabbi Miller just mentioned, that if Jews are not going to take care of their own, then who will? So that there's a desire to try to aid those Jews who are in need, who otherwise would not receive support, let alone Jewish institutions that will not be supported by the government because of separation of church and state.
I think also from my experience, going back to what you said at the beginning there, Dr. Werthammer, the idea that there's a singular motivation that people can identify with and mark as being the reason why they're giving is probably not going to give the full picture because people are so complex today. They're balancing, I'm finding in my own community, they balance between their American values, their Jewish values, the values of the community in which they live. All of those are playing a role in shaping the decisions that they're making. There's not a single motivation. But I will say that one of the things I've observed is that a big factor in people giving within the Jewish community is a response to need, particularly in times of trauma. And within my own local community, we've seen that repeatedly after each of the recent hurricanes in the last 10 years. Every time there's a major hurricane, people step up. They want to do things. They want to find ways to help, to give of their time, their talent, and their resources. But also on a larger scale, at a time when anti-Semitism is on the rise, that's becoming a big motivating factor in people wanting to give, whether it's to strengthen a sense of Jewish identity by investing in organizations like synagogues, like day schools, like summer camps that are key in developing Jewish identity, whether it's work at giving to help harden institutions to protect them in a time when there's rising violence, or also whether it's a response to what's happening in Israel. These are the key things that when traumatic incidents happen, like October 7th, people quickly rise up and say, where can I give? How can I give? In our community, after October 7th, when there was a period where there was really no resources going from America to Israel, our congregation managed to gather up 22 duffels full of supplies and get them to Israel on the first flights to go from America to Israel afterwards and just distribute them to whoever we could. And people came out of the woodwork to want to donate things, going to the local shop and buying out all the gloves, buying out all the shirts, just because they wanted to do something.
Yes.
And I think that's that beautiful response to need and to wanting to help is just, it's part of what's ingrained in their identity. And I think if they were to really dig deep, it's just part of their Jewish identity.
Right. I'd like to just add to that, because I believe that what you just said is right on. But I want to add one additional element to this story, and that is the model of their parents and grandparents is often a key factor in this story. And people, when you ask them, will in fact make reference to that model. And there's a practical application here to what I'm referring to. But what people will say is that I saw how my parents stepped up at a time of crisis, for example, at a time of emergency. I saw that we don't see much of this happening anymore today, but there was a time when people, especially raising money for Jewish institutions, would ring doorbells and would come around. And I saw that my parents, instead of shooing those people away, gave them some cash or wrote a check out for them. And that inspires me. That's what people will say. And the reason I'm raising this is the kind of the practical dimension of this is, to attend to the role that family members, especially parents and grandparents, play as role models, and to be quite explicit. I'm talking now here about religious leaders, when they speak with their congregants, to be explicit about how there's something that you can do that can have and often does have a profound impact upon younger people because you serve as role models.
I'd be curious to know that. I want to go deeper with you on this.
Please.
Because I see something in my community. I'm curious how your research plays it out. I notice in our community, giving is more and more digital. It's less and less something you can touch and see that's happening. I remember in my childhood, the little blue boxes for JNF.
Yes, exactly right.
I remember tzedakah being passed around every time I went to religious school. I remember my parents making gifts and I would be aware of it.
Yes.
In this digital age where so much of it happens invisibly.
Yes.
I'm wondering if when you're talking to people for your research, the older generations, I imagine, give the, oh, my parents, my grandparents gave. What are you seeing in the younger generations today?
Right. So I don't know the answer to that question because it's hard to know what really goes on in people's homes.
Sure.
Right. But I want to make reference to a program called the Jewish, the Jewish Funders Pledge. I think it may be called the Jewish Giving Pledge. I can't recall the exact title. There are 130,000 families have signed up for this.
Wow.
And what the pledge is that these people commit themselves to giving whatever testamentary gifts they give, in other words, whatever they write in their will, that will go for charitable causes, 50% of it should go to Jewish causes. But the most important step in this whole thing is that these people commit to having conversations with their children and grandchildren about what's important to them, what their values are, as a way then of teaching, explaining to the next generations what they value. Now, that's not the same as they're seeing how the money is being transferred, but it is very much a way of opening a conversation about what my values are and why it's important for me to give. And it's not only to give to Jewish causes, but also to give to non-sectarian causes.
Well, this is the direction I was curious about myself, because I think across religions, there's this decline narrative.
Yes.
Of millennials or Gen Z, you know, not being as generous as generations before them. But we're actually, while that's the narrative, we're also seeing actually they're just giving very differently. They're participating in civic and societal causes very differently. But curious from either of your perspectives, whether it's from research and the work that you've done out in communities or from your specific community, if you were going to respond to that decline narrative that's out there, how would you respond to that and invite people maybe to think a little bit differently about how folks are participating today?
I think it's a great point, and I think it's a mistake to write off generations because they're behaving differently than the ones that came before them. And I'll say I see it in my community because I have a community that age-wise is more older than younger families because we're in a Southwest Florida. And I'll often hear the narrative of, oh, why aren't the young people stepping up the way that I did before? And my response is, why don't we look at this as how are they stepping up differently than we did before? And I think the same goes when it comes to philanthropy and Jewish giving is it's not a question of whether they're doing it. It's a question of how are they doing it and how do you meet them where they are? And from a practical standpoint, that means a lot of times letting go of some of the older models that while they might have found success before may not be the approach to fundraising or development that work best with the upcoming generations. I think of the idea that used to happen long ago in the Jewish community of card calling, that they would have cards and they would do phone campaigns where they'd say, well, on your card, you gave last year X and we think you should give Y this year. Will you do it?
And the Y is always higher.
Right. And the Y is always higher. Or they would call you out in a public meeting setting. Oh, who's going to give this? Well, why aren't you standing up? You last year. Mm-hmm. That kind of approach might have worked with a particular generation. It does not speak at all to today's generations. Mm-hmm. And so you have to find ways to approach them differently. I find starting, instead of approaching it that way, it's about telling the story. It's about tying in the narrative. It's about relating to them the values that are important. And that is a better motivating factor rather than, this is what your father gave, why aren't you giving at this level? So it's figuring out new ways to approach, but it's acknowledging that it's going to be a different experience than it was a generation ago.
Yes. I also think we should be cautious about not assuming that just because a generational cohort behaves one way at the age of 40, that they will behave the same way at the age of 55.
Sure.
And we know that families, younger families today, are hard-pressed in ways that their elders were not necessarily, in terms of their finances. And so as people get older, this generation, whether it's millennials or whether it's Gen Z, as they get older, their approaches may change also. Now, that may be wishful thinking on my part, but I certainly don't think that we should assume that everything is fixed in stone, because in so many ways we're at a time that's just the opposite of static. There's a great deal of fluidity in many areas of American life, including philanthropy.
I'd love to transition to nonprofits, because we have some folks who might be listening from that perspective right now, leading religious nonprofits across the country. As you have seen or engaged with religious nonprofit leaders, Jewish nonprofit leaders, what strategies and practices have you seen as being successful in their way of garnering funds, but also maintaining relationships with Jewish funders or funders that are open to funding Jewish causes in the in their communities?
So I could start with two. One of them, which is nothing new, but it continues to be utilized, is I'm coming back to the point about card calling and the social dimension of philanthropy. We know that in so many areas of people's lives, their social networks influence them. We know that how a person votes is often influenced by how that person's friends vote, that people are more likely to smoke when their friends are smokers. And with philanthropy also, they're more likely to give when they know that their peers are giving also. And so one of the techniques that's being used is to bring together peers, sometimes who are in the same general field, occupational field, I mean, people who work in as lawyers, people who work as physicians, people who work in the investment banking field, bringing them together. And the interaction with peers, first of all, they enjoy the networking, but they're also influenced by their peers. So that's one part of it. The other part of it, though, is that, and this puts a burden on many not-for-profits, that they have to demonstrate what they're really accomplishing with that money. And especially at a time when people feel that there are various crises, to demonstrate that that they're addressing those crises. I think that some organizations that have been unable to demonstrate what they're doing specifically in this moment of challenge, they're having much more difficulty raising funds than those that can say, look, we're raising this money and we are moving with speed to get those funds to the causes that are most in need. We are getting the money to the food pantry. We're getting the money to counseling services. We're getting money to synagogues who are doing X, Y, and Z to bring together Jews at a time of stress for Jews. I can elaborate on other examples of that, but I think those are two techniques that are being used that I think have applicability, again, well outside of the Jewish community.
I think for a lot of religious nonprofits, it's also that it's not a level playing field. Mm-hmm. They're often competing not just against other religious nonprofits or other nonprofits, they're also competing against major institutions that in the fields of development often have invested far more resources towards trying to do the fundraising they want to do for their organization more than the religious organization itself. I'll never forget the conversation I had years ago with a colleague who is a rabbi of a very large, successful synagogue in Manhattan. When I asked him about development and what it was like competing with the other synagogues, he looked at me and said, "I'm not competing with the other synagogues. I'm competing with the Met. I'm competing with the NYU Medical Center. I'm competing with all these other major institutions of New York City who are all trying to solicit my members to give to them instead of giving to our synagogue." And they have these wonderful, huge teams that are working to do this. We're a synagogue. That's not where our focus is. And it's the same for many other religious nonprofits. It's an unlevel playing field, and that's difficult for them. But I do believe they have an advantage in a way, because they can come at these conversations from a place of faith. They can come at it from a place of shared values and stories, and to create a vision of something that's meaningful in a way that other organizations just can't, because it's a deeper personal connection. And when they do that, and they do something, and they do the follow-up stewardship piece, that can really put them in a very positive position. And I think that's where I find also religious organizations have to change their mentality, that and remember to thank their donors. And they put the emphasis on making it clear you're appreciated for what you're giving. Whatever you're giving, you're appreciated. That's, again, that social aspect. It's the feeling of having value, of finding merit in my gift means something.
Right.
And that the organization appreciates what I'm doing for it. So they might not be on a level playing field from a resource standpoint, but they have other abilities that are there for them to make up for that, and I think in many ways succeed.
Right. And you put your finger on something very important here as well, and that is the personal element to this story. We know that when a family member is stricken by a particular kind of illness, that there's a likelihood that that family will want to invest in research, medical research about that illness. We know that when a Jewish organization, but it could be any kind of organization that is particularly strong at reaching out to college students, let's say, and involving them in constructive activities, that family members appreciate that a lot, and they can relate much more personally then to that organization. And I think it's finding that the meeting point between the families' interests, needs, and even history, and the types of services that not-for-profits can provide that might meet that particular need.
That's great. Thank you all. I'm specifically thinking about the folks listening in on this, waking up thinking, how do I be a faith leader in this world and fundraise? How do I claim the identity of my faith honestly and truthfully in a world that is asking me, telling me I'm too religious for this set of funding and not religious enough for this set of funding? The story of religious leaders across our country, I think, would resonate with that reality. But specifically from Jewish history, what would you say to faith leaders today that are trying desperately to fundraise in the societal climate? What insight from Jewish history would you want them to remember, whether they identify as being Jewish or not, but right, something that they could really connect with as they nurture generosity in their own communities?
Right. I would focus on one particular individual as a kind of case study. At the end of the 19th century into the early decades of the 20th century, the head of Sears Roebuck was a man by the name of Julius Rosenwald. Julius Rosenwald was a member of a Reformed temple in Chicago and was heavily influenced by his rabbi. He used to confer with his rabbi, and his rabbi was actively involved in advising him on, again, not on the nitty-gritty of dollars and cents on, or his business, but on the kinds of causes and the kinds of values that the rabbi had. And eventually Julius Rosenwald became, as best as I know, the largest Jewish giver in the United States at the time. And he gave both to Jewish causes. He famously, in the right after World War I, made $1 million commitment. In those days, $1 million was real money, to aid Jews in Eastern Europe. And at the same time, Julius Rosenwald funded a large network, the largest network of what were then called black schools, African-American schools in the South. And he did both under the influence of his rabbi. So what I would say to clergy is that don't underestimate your ability to influence your congregants, not only to raise money for your congregation, but also to help them develop a much broader philanthropic agenda. How that is balanced between Jewish and non-sectarian is one of the questions, of course. But rather than be seen as, oh, the rabbi is only interested in raising dollars for this synagogue, but to look at the much larger picture. And religious leaders can have that influence. Now, some of you may be thinking, yeah, but a lot of people don't show up, don't come to me. That's where it becomes more challenging.
Well, as a rabbi, like what Jewish traditions have you pulled on for yourself in inviting people to live generous lives and participating in the work of your synagogue and the work of the community?
I find in my synagogue and in the work that I'm doing, it's being present and being personal with the people and having a relationship with them. That Rosenwald story, I love that. And that speaks to the power that we have as faith leaders to be present with someone and to share with them in a way. I think the mistake sometimes that happens is we come into it and we either get really big eyes because we see, oh, look at the financial potential this person has. We look at the car they drive, look at the job they do. Rather than meeting the person where they are, getting to share with them, connect with them, and inspire them through the stories, the vision, and the values that are there as part of the conversation. And there's always opportunities to get people to give. They're going to, when you invite them to be a part of making that vision a reality. And I think that's what was happening with Rosenwald's rabbi, sharing the story, sharing the message, getting that across. And I think every one of us has that potential in our own communities, whether we're working in a synagogue setting or in some other Jewish nonprofit setting, sharing those pieces, connecting with people, meeting them where they are, has a lot of value. And those relationships then lead to that generosity from the heart because mm-hmm. you understand where the person is coming from and you understand what's important to them. And you're not seeing them as a means. You're inviting them to be a part of something bigger than themselves. And people really appreciate being invited to make a difference.
I love that. Thank you. Okay, I've got one last question for you, Jack, as we close out. Why does studying the history of Jewish philanthropy matter for understanding religious giving today? Why do we need to care about this?
Well, it forms a case study in American philanthropic life, and it kind of I can circle back to your initial question to me: to what extent is Jewish giving distinctive? To what extent are there important parallels to what's happening in American philanthropy in general? And the answer is both. Jews in this country certainly give through the same vehicles as their non-Jewish peers do. They establish foundations. When donor-advised funds become much more popular, Jews have opened donor-advised funds. Various organizations that in the past had been closed to Jewish givers, including boards of those organizations, then it's been much more likely that Jews have participated and given generously to those non-sectarian organizations, on the one hand. On the other hand, Jews serve as a case study of a population that, despite the fact that the donor base is shrinking, continues to acknowledge that they have a special responsibility to support specifically Jewish institutions, because nobody else is going to do that. And there are parallels to that in many other, among many other American ethnic groups and religious groups as well. So I think that there's a story there that both is universal as well as particularistic, but both can be learned from.
Amazing. Thank you both so much for this rich conversation. You've helped us see how generosity rooted in history, as well as faith, as well as community, continues to shape not only Jewish life, but the broader landscape of religious giving. We're grateful for the depth and perspective you've brought, and we look forward to see how these insights will inspire the next generation of faith and philanthropic leaders. Thank you.
Thank you.